next week on the programme, we'll be doing what we do every year, which is giving you an idea of what kind of books you might give as Christmas presents. But just ahead of that, a book which has been recently published is called The Unnatural History of Animals, Tales from a Zoological Museum by Martin Linney. Richard Collins, you've been having a look at this for us.
Yes, I have, Derek. And natural history books are worthy and interesting, but some of them can be very difficult to plough through, I have to confess. But this one is a great exception. The old slogan of the News of the World was, all human life is there. In this case, all human and animal life is in this book. It's a marvellous book. Cultural resonance, historical resonances, and a great diversity of topics. Beautifully written. I have the highest regard for it.
Well, you spoke to the writer of this book, who also happens to be the curator of the museum.
Martin, congratulations on a superb book. It's informative.
Oh, thank you.
It's entertaining and it's quite encyclopedic in its scope. It's the history of the Zoological Museum in Trinity College, Dublin.
It dates back, would you believe, to 1777. So it's been around a long time. And it's in its present location in the Zoology Building since 1876. And its function was to teach students of zoology. That's still its main function today, because we get a lot of students coming into the university wanting to do zoology. And a large part of their course is animal diversity, learning about how animals are classified, what makes them different to each other. So its main function is a teaching one, small amount of research, and in recent years, outreach and education.
Well, now it has been associated with the great and the good. One of its founders was Joseph Patton, who was on Captain Cook's second voyage. And indeed, he was a doctor and he may have saved the great captain's life. Is that true?
That's true. Captain James Cook was failing in health and they tried everything to restore him to good health. But there was a lack of nutritious food on board because they're well into their voyage at that stage. So they sacrificed the cook's dog and he made a nutritious broth from that and dispensed it to Captain Cook, and he made a remarkable recovery.
Also, famous creatures are associated with your museum. One of them, there is a phrase of Darwin's that there is no greater anomaly than a bird which cannot fly. And of course, a famous bird around Ireland which couldn't fly was the great auk. And you give a graphic account of the last days of the great auk, and you have a specimen in your museum. Can you develop that for us?
Oh, Richard, we have an absolute gem of a specimen of the great auk. Just great auk, just to give them a sort of a brief description to your listeners. They were less than a metre tall, about 75 centimetres tall. They were like a bird in dinner jacket. They had a black back and a white front. An enormous beak in proportion to its head. But the really characteristic feature of this bird was its wings, or as I say, its lack of wings. Its wings were tiny. It was an evolutionary trade-off, really, to increase their ability swimming in water, underwater, by losing the wings or reducing the wings to a very small size. They were a flightless bird. And that came with costs and benefits. The benefit was that they could dive to 30 metres. They could hold their breath for 15 minutes underwater. So their aerodynamic shape without these wings really increased their ability to hunt. The problem was that because they couldn't fly, they couldn't escape predators. And the biggest predator, of course, was man, us. And they nested on sites all across the North Atlantic, Newfoundland, Greenland. And they avoided land at all costs, but they had to come ashore to breed. They made it for life. They laid one egg. And once man began to build boats, they discovered the great auk and discovered that they were tasty to eat. So slaughter continued every summer on an industrial scale, has to be said. And even though these birds existed in their millions, they were basically slaughtered to extinction.
Well, now the specimen you have was contributed by another famous naturalist, Robert Birkett, and he got a pension for doing so. I mean, £60 a year doesn't sound much, but £60 in those days was a considerable sum
of
today's
money.
How did that come about? That is an extraordinary story. I don't think that anyone bringing in a specimen today would get the equivalent from Trinity College, would they?
Well, first of all, our great auk, Ireland's last great auk, we call it, because there isn't another one in Ireland. There are only 78 specimens worldwide, Richard, so it's a real rarity. It's our book of Kells, to be quite honest with you. But it was captured off Brownstown Head, just outside Waterford Harbour, in 1834. And it became extinct 10 years later in 1844. And that's when it was donated to our museum by the Venerable Dr. Burkitt. When he donated the museum, actually, he wasn't that happy because he felt he may have been duped about its rarity and its value. He knew it was a great auk. He knew it was valuable. But the college didn't confer any kind of benefit to him. And he feels they hid the true value of the great auk from him. And when he visited there, he noted that there wasn't even a plaque recording his donation. His name wasn't beside the great auk. All that was changed some years later when, as you say, they conferred a great auk pension, which he enjoyed for a few years. And now, since I became a great curator, he has a nice little plaque saying that he was the last great auk in Ireland, extinct in 1844, donated by Dr. Burkitt.
Now, in your book, you mentioned that you're the curator and you praise another curator, Marjorie Courtney Latimer. And she contributed a most famous specimen of a fish to the South African Museum. And you have a specimen of this in your coelacanth.
But unfortunately, we don't have a specimen. We have models of it, all right. There is a specimen in the Ulster Museum, but we don't have one, unfortunately. A living fossil there, the coelacanth, a great story, that. Definitely. But unfortunately, I can't claim to be a custodian of a coelacanth. But we write about that in the context of living fossils and what they represent and how they haven't changed in thousands of years.
I'm glad to see that you don't neglect the lesser folk of the animal world and what we would think of as the lesser folk of the animal world. One of them is the leech, the medicinal leech. You mentioned in your book that Ireland was the first country in which the medicinal leech became extinct. Now, the medicinal leech almost changed the course of history because it might have brought about the opposite victory in the Battle of Waterloo. Is that right?
That's absolutely correct. Napoleon Bonaparte was, before each battle, he would make it his business to parade along his forces on his white horse and, you know, give them encouragement for the battle ahead. But he suffered from piles. He suffered from hemorrhoids. And his surgeon took the scalpel to his royal bottom and place some leeches, medicinal leeches, on his bottom because they were a source of alleviation for piles at the time. Most chemists worth their salt and most hospitals worth their salt had a container full of medicinal leeches, which they took out to repair their wounds, and the leech would feed on these scars and keep the wound clean and aid its repair.
Do you have exhibits of mounted specimens, if you can describe a mounted leech as something real?
Yeah, we do.
You do? Marvellous.
We do.
Now, that must be of great interest to medical students and biological students. You don't neglect these little things. For instance, vampire bats.
Yeah. That's right.
Bed lice, roundworms, jellyfish, all these kinds of creepy crawly things that we tend to ignore. You exhibit all of these, and these are probably more relevant to your students than anything else.
Yeah, so the students pretty much learn everything from tiny little microscopic animals right up to elephants and whales. Would you believe that in the heart of Trinity College there's a zoological museum with elephants and giraffe and whales hanging from the ceiling? I mean, who would have known that? It's sometimes called Dublin's best kept secret because of that. But they're all still there. 25,000 specimens dating back over 200 years. Not all on display, of course, but all the important ones that I talk about in the book are all there on display for visitors.
Martin, it's a wonderful book, and I'm sure the museum will be open again and the public will be, welcome, if not invited to attend.
Absolutely. And you're very welcome to come and visit Her Majesty, your great auk, when the museum reopens in the summer.
You'll never get me out of the place. Thank you, Martin.
Thank you very much, Richard. Take care.
Details, as always, on the website, rte.ie/Mooney. That's all we have time for tonight. Till next week at the same time. Goodbye, goodbye, goodbye.